that conceit first. Is that okay? All right, guys, so this is the Saturday morning call. It's evening time in the United States for Callum. By the way, Paul, where are you?
I'm over in England, but originally from the U.S., yeah.
Okay, so it's late for you. What time is it there?
Holy cow. It's 2 a.m.
All right. Okay, so Ivan has asked about conceit. And I want to answer that first, and then we'll get into some practice items. Now, first off, conceit is one of the high fetters. It's, in fact, one of the last things to go, if you can think of it as your practice. It's something that eventually is both to be worked on, and it eventually falls apart all on its own. That when we begin with the concept that who we think we are is not who we actually are, that we're actually a moving target, then that will help break down that conceit, which is actually comparing ourselves to others. All right, and in that word conceit, the Pali word is mana, and it actually has to do with competition. That in the fact, on the planet Earth, there is a lot of competition. That we grew up in the animal world with competition for survival. But nowadays, the way that society works, the competition is not about survival. You are not being half eaten by a alligator right now. And so you're safe. And so the competition actually is kind of irrelevant, and yet it's a holdover from our deep, dark past. You could even say that competition is right into our DNA. And that we compare ourselves with others and compare ourselves with society and compare ourselves with, for instance, when we're reading a book, we start to compare ourselves with what's in the book. We're always doing that. And when we do that, it's a good point to recognize that we're actually comparing ourselves with someone or something, or putting ourselves up as a comparison. This is what we is better than to understand as comparing as opposed to conceit. But the conceit is what shows out. That's what's visible. Being conceited means that you're actually expressing or telling other people how good you are. So you could see that the comparison comes first and then the conceit comes after. Or that the conceit is the outcome of the comparison. And that what we actually can do instead is let whatever comparisons that we do wind up in merely good feelings, without it having to be an I, me, or mine. You see, that's the point about conceit, is it's always selfish. There's always an I, me, and mine in the conceit. But the issue in the first place was comparing ourselves and comparing things. That in fact, this is also a reference to what you would refer to as judgment. And judgment.
You know what?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Sorry.
Don't be sorry. You know I'm what? Not judging you.
Do you mind if I interrupt, Dom Marat?
Please do. This is an open discussion.
All right. That you talked about conceit, and this was like, I was like 14 or whatever, and we moved into this place, and these two girls came up to me, and they say, "You are conceited." And I proudly walked up to them and said, "Yes, I am conceited." And I was like,
here's something interesting. When someone calls another person conceited, they can only do so out of their own conceit. So everybody's conceited. That in fact, you could see the word conceit in the sense of that we're with it. We're in it. The word come actually is coming from the Latin. Any word that starts with come, you could use the word with. All right. So conceit means that this is my place. And so we take that on. And that here's a question for you. When these girls called you conceited, what was your feeling?
What's that?
What was your feeling?
Proud. I had pride. I was. Yeah. It wasn't wholesome. You know what I mean?
What wasn't wholesome? Them saying it or you owning it?
Me owning it.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that's the best way to handle anybody who is intending to insult. I mean, when they say that, when anybody says that, you're conceited, it's an insult.
Yeah. I took it on.
All right. And but, so the answer always the way, is agree like, with them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You got me. Ha ha. And so there's no problem with that. What the problem is that when people are comparing themselves with each other and they come up with different answers, that I'm better than you are. But that's in fact what they want. Actually, you could say that when somebody calls you conceited, that's an invitation for a fight. They want an argument. You can see that somebody's conceited, but you don't have to rub it in their face. You can have fun with it instead. And it's a matter of comparison. Now, before you started mentioning that, I was going to tell one of Bhikkhu Buddhadasa's favorite stories that comes out of the Bible of Adam and Eve. The story of Adam and Eve is not the story that common Christianity thinks. They're, generally, what happens is a story has a moral to it. It's got an ending. It's got a point to it. But many people will get hung up in the story itself. All right? The example would be Aesop's Fables of the fox jumping for the grapes. And then when he can't get them, he calls them sour. All right? Now, the whole point is that foxes don't talk. They generally don't jump for grapes. So, in the story of Adam and Eve, people get hung up on talking snakes, and the woman did it first, and fig leaves and apples and God throwing them out of the Garden of Eden. To where the reality is that if you are in a garden, if you are in paradise, and you start going around judging it as good or evil, you're going to have to put up with the results of your judgments. That's what eating of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil actually means, is that when you judge things as this is good and this is bad, you wind up having to eat that. And basically, what that actually then is conceit. We have to actually eat our own conceit when we go around judging, I like this and I like that, or I'm better than this and I'm better than that. And so the way to handle that is to recognize that everything, the way that it is, the reality of the situation is how it is, and that we normally judge reality based upon either how we have been taught that it should be, or we judge it according to what we want. Rather than reality. So we've got a three-way split here. What it should be, according to the rules, the definitions, all of that, we have it according to the how we want it, our inner child. And then we have the third one, which is reality. You can also think of this as the middle path. One extreme is how things should be. The other extreme is how we want things to be, and the middle point, the reality, is how things are. And how things are is actually a paradise. And if we stop judging the paradise, we can begin to live in paradise. In other words, create your own heaven by stop creating your hell. If you stop creating your hells, then paradise will be naturally there. This is what, in fact, the way that we operate then is with this conceit, which is that comparing, I'm better than they are. But sometimes we find with that comparison that we lose. But in fact, if we win, it's called pride, and it's often, well, hello, Tim. Good to see you, as well as Damodas. So we're talking about conceit and pride today, that if we do a comparison and we compare ourselves to another person, we either win or lose. Now, when we do that comparison, guess what? We're the ones, when we do the comparison, that sets up the criteria for the comparison. But in fact, the reality is that things are way too complicated. A human being has tens of thousands of traits, and those traits are in motion, in a combination, and everything is in flux on both sides. And so when we do a comparison, we limit that down certain select bit of criteria. For instance, two kids comparing with each other because one of them got a higher score on a math test, and that's the only criteria they've got. Where in fact, there's tens of thousands of pieces of criteria. One's got a job, the other one doesn't. Somebody's on the band and somebody's on the football team, and there's, how can these guys compare each other when things are so diverse? And yet they go around comparing each other. It happens in high school big time because of the ignorance of things are way more complicated and they're trying to simplify it down so that they can make that comparison. So when you recognize that you choose the way that you're comparing, that means that already before you make the comparison, you're setting it up for whether you're going to win or lose based upon the criteria that you select. And those of us who were in the habit of being a victim will set up the criteria to prove that we're a victim. And those of us who are bullies will set up the criteria to prove that we're bullies. And those who are real winners don't set up the criteria for comparison because they're already confident.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Those who of us who live in reality do not go to compare other people based upon a set of criteria of either how things are supposed to be or how we want things to be, but whether we just leave things the way they are. And then there's no more conceit of I, me, or mine and what I want. Bhikkhu Buddhadasa says it like this, is nothing is worth clinging to as I, me, or mine. Some things are worth clinging to, but clinging to them in the sense of reality, in the sense of attachment to this present moment, attaching to reality.
That's a good attachment to have to reality.
Mm-hmm. But attaching to things as if it belongs to me or as if I'm comparing myself to it, that's when the I, me's, and mine's come into play. And that's what leads us into dissatisfaction. But if you can accept everything as it is satisfying, satisfactory, then you can see that what other definition could you have of paradise? Other than everything is satisfying, everything is satisfactory.
I agree.
And so if we can bring it to that.
Is satisfactory.
All right. So now let's start talking about how we can get ourselves into that state of satisfaction so that we can stop being conceited, stop comparing ourselves with others. That generally, when we're doing that, it's because we have unwholesome thoughts. The unwholesome thoughts about basically either I don't like it or the unwholesome thoughts of that's not how it's supposed to be. He shouldn't do that. They shouldn't kick that monk out of that temple. Okay, that's a conceited kind of statement. And when we make those statements, we have to know that that's the statement that we're making and that's how we feel about it. To where, in fact, the monks that are kicking that other monk out of the temple, they've got their own conceit. They've got their own attitudes. And then the monk who's getting kicked out of the temple, he's got his own conceit and his own attitudes. I'm using that as an example because that's something that's happening right now. But only Michael knows the actual story. But the point is that you can see that everybody has their own position. Yeah. And everybody takes their own attitude of, oh, they should not kick that monk out. The other position is, oh, what am I, oh, poor me, they've kicked me out. And the attitude of, oh, he's not good enough for us. And all of these are, go ahead.
I've seen it on so many poker tables.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the same game.
So here's where we can begin to see that. Is by recognizing it from the position of what kind of thoughts and what kind of feelings we have. Because we do have thoughts and feelings of conceit. We have thoughts and feelings of all kinds of things. Can we start to watch and become aware of that stuff?
And yeah, I'm aware
then
of it.
Can
and
we
you know what?
Change
it? It feels unwholesome. It feels unwholesome. If I feel conceited, I was just thinking about, I am conceited. Wow, it's very unwholesome. I can feel it immediately.
But seeing that you're conceited is wholesome. Seeing the reality as it is wholesome.
Yes,
being conceited and saying that I'm not conceited, that's two levels of deceit.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
But we go around, like I said, the conceit is very, very deep. It goes all the way back into our DNA, and it's going to be there in the language and the way that we speak. But what we can do to get started then is by practicing the Eightfold Noble Path. And that is by starting to see these thoughts that we have that have issues of comparisons, conceit, that's based upon our thoughts about how things should be or how we want them to be, and being disappointed and disgusted and not getting what we want. And then lying to ourselves about, oh, I deserve that. I should be able to get it. Why can't I have it? Rather than the reality of the situation is just keep plugging at it. You've probably heard the Chinese philosophy of a trip of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Have you heard that? Very famous, right? But most of us miss the point. Why? It's because it's not the first single step. It's this single step. You have to make that step right now. This is the step that we're making. And so the whole point about the trip of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Every step along the way is a single step. And so the trip of 900 miles still begins with this single step. Now, what am I referring to as a single step here is our right effort. We have to take the effort to make a change, to move from 900 miles direct distance into 900 miles minus one step. We take that step, and then we take another step, and then we take another step, over and over and over again. In fact, making sure that we're making a step, then the goal of 900 miles or 1,000 miles becomes irrelevant. In fact, 1,000 miles is the conceit. It's putting a destination, it's putting a goal out there. And in fact, wherever you go, that begins with a single step.
Yeah, right on.
It is a journey. You just see it as, let's just make one more step. Let's just do this. And this is what the Eightfold Noble Path is really a lot about. And that is that it begins with right view. Now, what we begin with right view in this sense is, let us say, at least going or heading or intending to go in the right direction, as opposed to wrong view, which means that we can get away with anything, that I'll do what I want. And then ordinary right view is, in fact, those rules, those standards, which says, oh, you got to do it correctly. You got to do it this way. You got to do it according to my rules. But the real right direction, the noble view, right view, is to see things the way they actually are, not how they're supposed to be, not how we want them to be, but actually how they are. And then the second point of the Eightfold Noble Path is to remember to take the right view. Now, when I say taking a view, I'm not talking about a viewpoint, a worldview, an idea, or a concept, which is still the set of rules. But rather, it's not a noun, it's a verb. It's not right view, it's right viewing. It's right looking. It's right investigating There's a big difference between investigating and an investigation. An investigation is a pile of papers in a folder that's sitting in some drawer in the police office. That's an investigation. But the investigation happened because someone was investigating. They were actually looking at what was going on, asking questions, looking and finding things. So this is how we're actually going to be working with our right noble view, is to look. And we're going to be looking basically in four different directions. These four directions are also known as the Satipatthana, or the four foundations of mindfulness, the four foundations of what we're actually going to look at. And we have to remember to look at all four of them. One is the body, the other one is the feelings, the other one is our mental attitude, and the fourth one is the moment-by-moment, momentary thoughts that we have that keep changing. And so, as we begin to practice, what that means is that we're building the skill to remember to practice. This does not take formal meditation. What it takes is whatever you're doing, wherever you are, look at what body postures you have, how does the body feel, what kind of feelings you have, what kind of emotions you have, what is your mental attitude, what are you thinking about? And if we keep looking at those things and stop having oughts, shoulds, woulds, coulds, and how things are supposed to be, or looking at it from the position of this is how I want it, we begin to look at how things actually are. And by doing so, we can begin to see that a lot of our thoughts are unwholesome, because a lot of our thoughts are based upon how things should be or how we want them to be, instead of how things actually are. So these are the two points then: to remember to look, and then to look with discernment. Is this wholesome or is this not wholesome? And then that third item, which we've already discussed about that single step then, so is to take the right effort to make a change, to move that foot, to go make that step in the right direction by throwing those unwholesome thoughts out, changing our mental attitude, changing the body into actually having the body being comfortable, safe, secure. And then the last one will be, we begin to feel like we're in paradise. So these are the four items that we're going to be practicing with, the four foundations of mindfulness, and we're going to be doing it by taking the right effort to change. Now, when we're actually watching the breathing going in and out long, we're actually applying the mind to that. The body is not going to naturally breathe correctly. It's going to be breathing, let us say, in a very conservative way. That we actually sometimes hold our breath, stop breathing, especially when we're afraid. You've heard of fight, flight, and freeze. Well, we spend a lot of time frozen in fear. And so we have to remember to take good, long, deep breaths. And when I say good, long, deep breaths, that doesn't mean to wear yourself out or work too hard. Just be very easy about taking an easy, long, and enjoy your breath. So in order to do that, though, we actually have to have the mind engaged. You can't let the breathing done just by the breathing. The mind's got to be involved with it. And with that, we can begin to change the way that we think and begin to change our mental attitude, the state of mind that we're in. And so this is where in Anapanasati, working closely with the Eightfold Noble Path, with that right effort, means that we begin to gladden the mind, to begin to brighten the mind, to take the mind out of the victim's position into the position of being a winner, with the attitude of I can do this. What can we do? We can change the thoughts that we're having. We can change the attitude that we have, and we can change the way we feel. The funny thing that I find in this society that we live in, worldwide society, in fact, is that very rarely are children taught that they can learn to control their feelings. Almost everyone is being punished for being out of control of their feelings, but they're never taught how to actually learn to control the way they feel. Well, how do we learn to control the way we feel? It's by changing our attitude about the way that we feel, to change the body so that the body is comfortable, relaxed, satisfied. Change the thoughts that we're having, gladdening the mind, brightening the mind. And when we are able to change the mental attitude and change the body, those things together will help us change the actual way we feel. And I generally ask students this. If right now, we're not talking about all the time or forevers or way out into the future, but right now, if you could feel the way that you wanted to feel, how would you feel?
Absolutely phenomenal, amazing.
Well, you can't feel that way all the time, but you can feel that way right now.
Yeah.
The feelings go up and down. You can feel phenomenal. Anybody want to help Paul feel phenomenal? Michael's got a great big grin on his face. What do you feel, Michael?
Oh, thank you, brother.
Spectacular.
Spectacular. All right.
Oh, wow. That's a great one.
All right. So we can learn to feel the way we want to feel by practicing feeling the way we want to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, look how little amount of time you actually spend intending to feel the way you want to feel. We don't remember that we can do that. We don't think about it. We think about the computer. We think about the car. We think about the laptop. We think about cleaning the house. We think about all kinds of stuff, but we don't think about how we feel, what the body is doing. What's our attitude? What's your attitude right now? If you could change your attitude, what kind of attitude would you have? Would you have the attitude of a winner or the attitude of a victim? What are you victimized by? Well, you're victimized by the things that you've always been victimized by in the sense of a habit. But you can change that habit. You can make that single step in the right direction of feeling the way you want to feel. And if you can feel the way that you want to feel, there's no reason to then have to compare yourself with others. Because they're feeling the way they want to feel. They just don't know that they have that choice.
And you know what? It's so amazing. Like in 3 seconds, you can say, it's amazing. You know?
Yes. You can, in fact, feel the way you want to feel. And we can practice doing that one feeling at a time, one step at a time, one mental attitude at a time. We can change it from, oh, poor me. Oh, I'm a victim. Oh, I've got so much work to do. Oh, they shouldn't do that. All this and that into, hey, everything is okay. Everything is just fine. Reality is reality. It's going to be the way reality is. Can we fit into reality rather than trying to fix reality so that it fits into what we want? Because we'll always be disappointed when we're trying to repair reality. Reality is going to be the way that it is. And it's operated by certain basic laws. I don't want to get too much deep into physics, but we've got the laws of gravity. They're always there. I'm accused of law of gravity because everybody understands what it is. If you trip and you don't catch yourself, you're going to fall. Gravity is there waiting on you. That gravity is there under that cup that's sitting on the table. So as soon as gravity, he's going to kick that cup off the table and it's going to fall to the floor, and he and gravity would like that floor not to be there, so that it keeps falling. In other words, gravity is always there. It's omniscient. It always knows. It always is powerful. I mean, look how much rocket fuel they have to spend to get a rocket into space. Gravity is pretty powerful. Omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent is always there. Well, isn't that the definition of God? So let gravity be your God. But gravity is not all of reality. We have chemistry. We have electromagnetic fields. We have all kinds of things that go into physics that bring up these four basic laws of nature. And they're always there. You can use them to your advantage, or you can ignore them and then be a victim by them. So what I'm saying here is that a good definition of God is reality. Reality is always there. And if we can learn to live in harmony with reality, we're living in atonement. We're living in the lap of God because God's real, if you want to use the word that way. But what we really have to deal with is reality, whether you call it God or Allah or
reality,
whatever you call it, you still have to deal with reality.
Can
you learn to become in harmony with reality? Because reality itself is that paradise. Can you begin to see your reality as a paradise? Your choice.
Oh, that's lovely. That's a lovely way to put it, Dhammaratu.
So this is the way we can begin to live our lives.
Body,
we have to practice.
Relax the body and gladden the mind.
Go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just saying, relax the body, gladden the mind and the body and the emotions with florid hallucinations of loveliness.
Mm-hmm. And we can practice that any time and any place that we can remember to do it. But it's not necessary that we practice formally. Western mentality, Western Buddhism has gotten themselves all stuck in a formal practice. You got to go pay $2,000 for a retreat and sit on the floor and follow all of the rules. To where, in fact, it's always the rules that cause us so much trouble, because the rules are always against reality. And so if we can stop living according to how things should be, because if you look at it like that, how things should be or how things ought to be is by definition against reality. Reality is this, and it should be that. We're living in an unreal world when we have a set of rules. Reality is this, and I want that, which means I'm living in delusion when I'm living according to what I want. Yes, Anna, go ahead.
I'm trying to understand I'm reading about the virtue right now, and I'm trying to understand it, and it's too complicated. Somehow it's very connected to reality, and that's what you... to the gravity, what you're talking about right now, but it's just, what is it exactly? What is a virtue in Buddhism means?
What is the word?
Virtue.
Virtue.
Michael, can you help her? Can you help me understand what she's saying?
Virtue.
Yeah.
Well, virtue is a set of rules about how things ought to be. Now, I would say that the teaching of the Buddha means that we only need one rule. And that one rule would be what we do have a choice about, and that is dukkha, dukkha nirodha. That's the only rule we need. In other words, don't hurt yourself and don't hurt other people. If you hurt other people, they'll hurt you back.
So how it's connected to concentration?
Well, I wouldn't use the word concentration. I would use the word over and over. Keep going. Keep making one step at a time. Concentration looks like that people are struggling and tense and trying hard. That's what concentration is. Basically, we're trying to take reality out of the situation so that it'll be the way that it should be or how we want it to be. A much better way of understanding concentration is one step at a time. This moment, do something. This next moment, do it again. This moment, do it again, over and over and over again. And what is that? That's dukkha, dukkha, nirodha. But now we do it again, and we do it later, over and over again. See the dukkha, see the unwholesome, see the unsatisfactory, see the desires, see the wants, see the oughts and shoulds that make up the duality, and come back to nature, come back to the reality the way that it is. Everything is okay, everything is fine. We begin to change our thoughts from wholesome, from unwholesome to wholesome, but we have to keep doing it over and over and over again. One of the little jokes that I like to say is that on every shampoo bottle, every one of the shampoos, whether it's made by Johnson & Johnson or Kimball's or whoever makes shampoo, whatever store it's in, they always have the entire teachings of the Buddha right there on the back of the bottle. The entire teachings of the Buddha is on the back of every shampoo bottle on the market. You go to any grocery store, 7-Eleven, wherever you go, and they're on the back of the bottle, it'll have the instructions, rinse and repeat. Rinse
Man,
and repeat.
I couldn't believe I couldn't remember that one. Good one.
Rinse and repeat. Okay, what does that rinse mean? Take the dukkha out of it and then do that again. Just keep taking the dukkha out of it. Taking your dissatisfactions out. Your dissatisfactions of I want this, or your dissatisfactions of that ought to be like that. And keep taking those dissatisfactions out. And repeat that. Rinse and repeat, which is exactly the same thing as the teaching of dukkha, dukkha nirodha. Don't harm people, because they'll come back. I mean, anybody that you harm is going to be conceited. If they feel harmed, they feel a victim. Then they want to compete. They're going to come back after you. Don't harm people. Don't hurt people. If you hurt them, you're creating a dukkha, and they're going to conceitedly reproduce it. So our job is to not harm anybody, to not harm ourselves, to not even have unwholesome thoughts. Let's have wholesome thoughts over and over and over and over again. Let's rinse that mind out and then rinse it out again and then rinse it out again. Repeat, repeat, repeat. That's the kind of way that we use the word concentration. Now, when we're rinsing the mind out of these unwholesome thoughts, we begin to have, by doing this over and over again, we begin to unify the mind. All right? When the mind has a set of rules, it ought to be like that. When we have the attitude of, oh, I want this to be like that. I want this. I have to have that. Then that creates a duality between you and reality. But when you're in harmony with reality, that means that the mind itself becomes unified. It becomes whole. And it has the support. Let me use the example of a wigwam or a teepee. American Indian style, or if you want, you can have a yurt, which is Mongolian. but they both have something in common, and that is that the teepee has a set of rigid long poles that are bound together at one top end. That is an example of samati, that all of the poles are supporting one another because they're tied together at the top. This is how you want to see your mind, is all of the components of the mind are tied together and are singular, even though you can go off in this direction and that direction mentally, you still have that unification of mind, and that unification of mind is reality. This is real. And this is the word that's in the Pali that's called samati. Samati actually means unification, and yet in English, because of some translator, perhaps in the 1880s, you know, 150 years ago or so, they made a mistranslation and translated the word samati into concentration. And since then, Western Buddhism has been a slave to and being victimized by this word concentration.
You know what, Dhammaratu, I would also add into that, like kind of a synergistic psychology onto it, that, oh man, the idea that it's not only the mind, but also family and stuff. I don't know. Sorry.
Well, you could begin to unify your family by beginning to unify your own mind.
Yeah.
If you were at division with your family, then the family is going to be at diverse with you. But if you were in harmony with your family, then family will become in harmony with you. Family is just another word for reality right now. Families are real. Okay, so if you were in harmony with them, not causing them any damage, not causing them any harm, not causing them any suffering, then they will return that to you out of their conceit. That in a way you could say that conceit actually has good qualities to it. That's where I'm coming to eventually to wrap this up, is that this harmony, this unity, is when all of us are trying to come together, and yet we look at it from the opposite of that, saying that we're going to in conceit, which means that we're trying to find a difference. We're trying to make little old good enough to be in reality, when in fact each one of us is already good enough to be in reality. Reality hasn't kicked you out yet. And so you're already, in a way, in reality. And so we can stop struggling to try to be part of nature, because we're already part of nature. The struggle is because we're deluded. We think that we're not good enough. And the reason for this is because we were all born a victim. Every human baby, in fact, every baby animal is also born as a victim. Even elephant babies can't stand up very well. Human babies can't stand up at all. We can't feed ourselves. We can't put our own diapers on. We can't control our bowels. We can't do anything like that. And so we start off as a victim, and then by the time we're 5 or 6 years old, we're put into school and told, you got to go to school, you got to learn your ABCs, your 1, 2, 3s, and that victimhood stays. It stays into high school. The reason why bullies are bullies in high school is because they feel victimized otherwise. And then those victims in high school that become bullies wind up being on the police force. The reason that police are bullies is because they actually inside deeply feel like they're victimized. It's dangerous out there. I mean, we got to carry a gun around. It's so bad. It's so dangerous. And look at all the people, how much they hate the cops. The cops don't realize that they create that hatred, that people are conceited about cops because the cops themselves behave the way that they do. So each one of us can see that as an example and recognize that it's time for us to stop being both sides of that, both the victim and the bully. And come someplace into between. There's a middle path in there that's real. Someplace between how things ought to be and how things we want them to be. The kid who wants things and wants it to be this way, he's being a victim. And the one who is out there with all the rules, it should be this, it should be that, that's the bully. And we move back and forth between being a bully and being a victim on a regular basis. And our thoughts are unwholesome as we do that. But when we come back to the position of everything is okay, everything is all right, we don't need the rules to tell us how things ought to be. Let's live in reality. Let's not go around trying to get something that we want to prove to ourselves that we're good enough. We're already good enough. We're already okay. Let us start talking to ourselves. Let's start practicing that. Let's rinse all of that oughts, woulds, shoulds, coulds, and all those desires out and just rest and say, everything's okay right now. No place to go, nothing to do. Wow, what a nice day it is. This is paradise.
Have you seen the stars above you? Woo!
So, David, what do you have to say about this?
One thing is, well, we can change the way we want to feel, but I think some people, they might say they actually like feeling angry or they like feeling sad. They prefer that rather than feeling happy. So What would you say to that?
That's a habit.
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing.
It's a habit. We get used to our habits. They're comfortable. We know what they are, even though they're really uncomfortable. And they don't want to change because they're afraid to change because they're a victim. In fact, in the bottom of every angry person, at the bottom of every bully, is a victim. People do not get angry unless they're already afraid. There is fear at the bottom of everything. Can you see how you are afraid and deal with that by telling yourself there's nothing to be afraid of? Everything is all right. Everything is fine. This is part of the practice. Everything is okay. Everything is fine. Be not afraid. Feel safe and secure. If you feel safe and secure, then you don't have to want anything to feel safe and secure. And you don't have to invent a lot of rules to make you feel safe and secure because you've already learned how to feel safe and secure. And those people who are angry actually fear and being a bully. The bully is trying to protect the little child inside. And so naturally, when people get in the habit of it, because see, the angry person, his only option, the reason why he would choose anger is because to him, his only option is to get beaten up by somebody else who's angry. He becomes their victim. He's going to be the victimizer. It's just always his top dog, underdog. One's on top and one's on the bottom. And the reality is they could be friends.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's the answer to that, David. Anything else?
I just want to say that the more I practice this, the more I realize this whole practice is about making things harmonious. Like even reframing this idea of conceit, like there's this dropping the arrogance and ignorance of the mind. I just want to say that.
Excellent. Yes, harmony, harmonious. Be at one. That at one moment is the same word as atonement. Okay, being in tune with reality rather than creating noise. I don't like reality. It should be this way. Or I don't like reality because I want it to be that way. These three points, by the way, are from Freud, his ego, superego, and id that Eric Byrne refers to as parent, adult, and child. We've got a parent inside about how things ought to be, the rules, the cop, the enforcer, the parent, and then we have the little child inside who feels victimized and wants to feel good so he can get what he wants in order to feel good. And then there's the adult. That's the reality. Let's start living our lives in the adult state and coming out of the parent and coming out of the child and start being an adult in the world. Being able to choose the way you want to feel instead of trying to apply some rule, something. So good, Ivan. How about you, Caleb? You got something to say?
Well, not as a sidetrack, but I think we did talk about concentration a little bit during this, and I had a question. Once I was meditating and I used a small silver object as like a silver colored object as like an object to meditation, and I noticed that after a while I might have focused on it too hard or something, and it started to do this weird thing where around me everything just became kind of dark and shadowy,
kind of,
and just darkened, like the lights turned down almost, and all I could see was just what I was looking at, like it was just focused on just that. And I was wondering if that was something like what happens
when people... Did you like that?
It was interesting. I was just surprised that it was possible because it was like a change of perception, you know?
Right. It is actually that. It's a change of perception. And that's all it is. It's just a change in perception. And yet there's a whole lot of people all over the world that use that kind of thing as meditation. And it's got some value. Here's the value. Is that while you're actually looking at that object and focusing on it or concentrating on it, guess what? You're not thinking about how things ought to be, and you're not thinking about how things should be. You're just thinking about that object, which is actually real.
That's true.
Isn't that amazing that you're just staying with an object that's real, and you begin to change your perception? Because the perception normally has the things of, I want this, or it should be like that. And you don't have any of those thoughts. The thoughts that you have is, this is it. Now, we can actually, one of the major changes I'd say that the Buddha made was in the time of the Buddha and even in today, but in the time of the Buddha, all of the meditators would meditate on an external object. This is where the four foundations of mindfulness come from, because they would take a silver object, a spoon, they would use water, fire, air. In fact, the air meditations have given us both astronomy, weather, meteorology, and astrophysics. People have been interested in the air and in the sky way too much.
And these are the casinos.
Okay, so we have these four kinds of objects, and what the Buddha did was that he took it and turned it from the outside onto the inside. And so it's better, instead of taking a silver object, take the silver mind. Gladden the mind, brighten the mind, make it sparkling. A winner's mind. A mind of an IQ of 20,000. I make a joke about that. I mean, if the internet can have horses with an IQ of 200, surely you can have an IQ of 20,000. That you're great, you're okay, wow, life is wonderful right now. You can take that as an object. You can take an object of how good you feel. Wow, spectacular. You can take an object of, look how fast the mind works. Start looking at how fast the mind changes. These are objects that you can have on the inside, which put into the Satipatthana. And those are much better objects to take than external objects. But you can get that same sort of focus, that same sort of getting. Basically, the self gets lost in the object. Why? Because we're not having any more selfish thoughts. So let's go have some very wholesome thoughts about, wow, isn't right now just, I mean, that's a better thing to do is just focus on reality, how nice reality is. This is a paradise. So, Damodas, do you have any comments?
No, it's good seeing you. Just thank you for everything, and it's good seeing everybody.
Yes, Damodas and I are old friends. Great. I'm glad to see you. Anna, do you have any final comments?
I was taken out of balance with the two teenage stories, so I'm kind of trying to put it to the tippy. I guess I will succeed in some point.
You can succeed right now. You're good enough right now.
When is the what is the right time for practice? I don't think 13 or 14 year old it's the right time to talk about acceptance of everything. Oh, it's fine.
Well, that in fact, kids need to start thinking about everything is okay, that they're acceptable. Acceptable by reality. They may not be acceptable by the bullies at school, but they're certainly acceptable by reality. For instance, gravity is not rejecting them and sending them out to outer space. But they live by the same gravity as everybody else does. They're not being rejected. They're being accepted.
Nothing else similar except gravity with us and teenagers. Anyway,
yeah. Yes, nature accepts us. This is exactly what the Christians are trying to get at when they say God loves you. Your environment loves you. It's here. Now, the reality is that God didn't make humanity perfect. But in fact, what happens is the humanity evolved to fit into God. We evolved to fit into the nature that we have. So nature was where we're going. Let's get into being natural. Let's get into being in the lap of God rather than thinking that God's going to do it for us. Nature doesn't care about you. You're part of it. You're in it. But you're going to, when you fall down, when gravity pulls you down to the ground, it's up to you to get back up. Gravity is not going to say, aha, I was just joking, and now you're standing again. Oh, no, if you fall, you're going to stay falling until you yourself get up. Gravity is not going to cut you any deals. You can cut your own deals. Up to you. And you can teach this even to 10-year-old girls. Or clients that you have, that they can live happily in the reality that they find.
Well said.
Michael, do you have any last? Go ahead, Paul. Go ahead.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Make friends with reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that anybody can learn, and anybody can practice. And I'd like to encourage people that are listening to this on YouTube to please come and join our calls, join our Discord. It's a great time. Even if you don't have any questions, we'd love to just see you here and have you hang out with us. And thank you, everyone, for being here today.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that, Michael. We have several calls. We have a call on, this is all Thai time, we have a call on Saturday morning, which would be evening time in the U.S. this time. We have a call on Sunday afternoon, which is morning time in the U.K. We have on Discord, we have a Saturday evening call. We have a midweek call. So we have 4 calls a week. As well as we're getting a website together that's actually coming together. We're actually beginning to use it rather than just building it. We're actually putting it into use. And so I heartily endorse everyone going and joining, filling in all the data. I mean, you're going to be part of this. A lot of people have signed up and they don't put a photo. They don't put their address. They don't put their website. They don't put a YouTube. And what we want you to do, go put your favorite YouTube up. Whatever that you like, put that in your YouTube. You don't have to have your own YouTube, but go put one in there. Put your address in. Put your email in. Put your website, your social media groups in. We've got room for almost anything that you want to know about a person, we put in there. Okay?
Absolutely.
Put your description.
Facebook, all that good stuff.
Right. And when we have all of that stuff in there, that means that we can connect with each other, that we can
Absolutely.
Go find things. Mm-hmm. Like today, for instance, we're looking for all of the Theravada watts in the UK, and wow, we found a whole bunch of stuff. Why? Because it's already in our database.
Okay, all right. Armavati, and I know down south, I'm over in Herefordshire, but Armavati, but it's so far, it's quite a ways away. Well,
yeah,
I'll find it.
Yeah, Chidhurst, but there's a lot of places. And when people say, oh, well, there's not so much Theravada in my neighborhood, that there's Mahayana. Well, Mahayana and Theravada are, let us say, practicing the same thing. Dukkha, Dukkha, Naroda. All you really have to see, though, is that the Mahayana have traditions from a certain country. Well,
right,
that means
right
that you have culture,
you know,
and
like
you
that.
Have Buddhism.
So Paul, if you need help finding a place, please reach out to me and I can help you out.
Mm-hmm.
Cheers, my friend.
Well, thank you all. I encourage you to join. Go find some friends.
Love you all.
Okay. Goodbye. See you later.
Have a good one.
Peace.